Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Joyce Tischler, who's the founder and general counsel of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
The Center for Biological Diversity filed a formal notice of intent to sue the Trump administration for allowing oil companies to dump waste from fracking and drilling into the Gulf of Mexico without evaluating the dangers to sea turtles, whales, and other imperiled marine life. In September, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency finalized the Clean Water Act permit for new and existing offshore gas and oil platforms operating in federal waters off the coast of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. The permit allows oil companies to dump unlimited amounts of waste fluid, including chemicals involved in fracking, into the Gulf of Mexico. According to Kristen Monsell, a senior attorney at the center, the Trump administration is letting the oil industry turn our oceans into toxic waste dumps. The EPA is supposed to protect water quality, not help pollute the Gulf. She further states that it's time for the courts to remind this agency that its mission is to safeguard the environment and public health. The center's notice of intent to sue highlights the fact that the agency's approval of the permit without studying the risk to imperiled species in the Gulf of Mexico is a violation of the Federal Endangered Species Act. Fracking chemicals and other contaminants in produced water raise grave ecological concerns because the Gulf of Mexico provides important habitat for whales, sea turtles, and fishes, as well as being federally designated critical habitat for the imperiled loggerhead sea turtles. Dolphins and other species in the Gulf are still suffering the lingering, devastating effects of 2010's Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Federal waters off of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi host the largest concentration of offshore oil and gas drilling activities in the country. Previous records requests revealed that oil companies dumped more than 75 billion gallons of wastewater into these waters in 2014 alone. Records also show that fracking has been on the rise in the Gulf of Mexico, and the EPA has failed to conduct any meaningful review of the environmental impacts of dumping fracking wastewater into the water. In October, the Trump administration announced plans to auction off more than 76 million acres of the Gulf of Mexico waters to oil companies. That lease sale, which is scheduled for March 2018, will be the largest oil sale in U.S. history. It includes federal waters off the coast of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, and could vastly expand drilling and fracking in the Gulf. At least 10 fracking chemicals routinely used in offshore fracking could kill or harm a broad variety of marine species, including marine mammals and fishes. The California Council on Science and Technology has identified some common fracking chemicals to be among the most toxic in the world to marine animals. To learn more on how to help stop fracking companies from dumping their waste into our important marine waters, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org.
Another case of animal abuse at a Tyson Foods chicken farm has surfaced. Undercover video taken by an investigator from the organization Compassion Over Killing was released earlier this month, which shows workers beating chickens to death. The video shows workers at a Tyson farm in Virginia stabbing, crushing, and stomping on chickens. Sick or injured birds are run over by forklifts and beaten with pipes studded with nails, while dying chickens are thrown into piles of dead ones. In response to the release of the video, 10 employees of the farm were fired, and a spokesman for Tyson said that they would conduct a video conference with managers at poultry facilities to stress their commitment to proper animal handling. The animal advocacy organization Compassion Over Killing sends its undercover investigators to meat processing plants to get jobs and then films conditions to document possible animal abuse. This is not the first time Compassion Over Killing has filmed mistreatment of animals at Tyson farms. In 2016, the group released video of Tyson employees throwing, punching, and kicking chickens at four Virginia facilities. Every time video of animal abuse on farms is released, meat company spokespersons say that they are outraged and that it was an isolated incident. but the frequency with which such videos are recorded shows that animal abuse at these farms is a standard practice.
They were sure she was dead. Bella, the 11-year-old shepherd mix, had been shoved into a garbage bag and beaten with a shovel. Her owner, Michael Gallagher, had first tied a zip tie around her neck before he began hitting her. When neighbors interceded and Gallagher fled, they were shocked to see that the garbage bag was still moving. Somehow, Bella was still alive. Although they rushed her to a veterinary hospital, her injuries were too severe and Bella had to be euthanized. New York prosecutors pursued the maximum sentence for Gallagher's crime after he pleaded guilty to a felony charge of aggravated cruelty to animals. Believe it or not, Gallagher will spend just 4 months in county jail for his crime. Why? Because in New York, as in so many other states, the animal cruelty statutes are in desperate need of updating. Sadly, the story is the same in states across the country. A patchwork of outdated state laws allows convicted animal abusers to keep their animals, prevents veterinarians from reporting suspected cruelty, and provides no felony provisions for neglect or abandonment. And there are currently no federal laws against these kinds of crimes. But you can take action today to help protect animals by signing a petition at aldf.org. Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with Joyce Tischler. Joyce co-founded the Animal Legal Defense Fund and served as its executive director for 25 years. With her leadership, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has filed groundbreaking and major impact lawsuits and laid the foundation necessary for animal law to be taken seriously in law schools, law firms, and bar associations across the country. Joyce handled some of Animal Legal Defense Fund's earliest cases, including a lawsuit that halted the U.S. Navy's plan to kill 5,000 wild burros. Joyce is an internationally recognized speaker and author of numerous publications, and has been quoted in the New York Times, Science Magazine, Washington Post, USA Today, Christian Science Monitor, Guardian, and People Magazine. Joyce currently serves as ALDF's general counsel and is affectionately known as the mother of animal law. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Joyce Tischler. Thanks for being with us, Joyce.
Well, my pleasure, Tom.
Joyce, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
Oh, I was born involved. I think animal advocates come in two flavors, the ones who were born into it and the ones who something happens. You know, they see a dog being abused or something else sets them off, and that's what sets them down the road. For me, it was genetic. As far back as I can remember, I had a special feeling about animals. And as soon as I could walk around the block, I was raised in New York City, and people actually do walk around blocks and survive. As soon as I could get out there, I was bringing home cats who I thought were lost and injured birds. And I had a very bad record with injured birds. I didn't do so well, so I got out of that business pretty quickly. But it was always there. When I was 9 years old, the family got a dog, and they let me name her. And I did what a nine-year-old does. Her name was Princess Fox. But she became my best friend. She was a little Sheltie, and she lived actually until I was about midway through law school.
Wow.
I just adored that dog. And it just went on like that. When I was in college, I went to Queens College in New York City, and there was a group of cats there, and we didn't know what feral meant at the time, but these were feral cats, most of them. You couldn't get near them or touch them, but they lived there, and we fed them and cared for them, and we actually started a somewhat illegal cat shelter on campus, rescuing, giving vet care, placing, and so that's part of what I did in my 4 years of college. So it was always there. It always followed whatever else I was doing.
And, you know, you talked about in some of your interviews about your formative years in the 60s and being influenced by the culture then. What made you think to switch sort of social justice movements and focus on animal protection?
You know, as you said, Tom, being a product of the 60s, or at least what I thought a product of the 60s should act like, I got involved in all sorts of social movements. Feminism coming in the 70s, civil rights, Latino rights later on. It just went on and on. I was always involved in the anti-war movement was actually where I started.
Yeah, of course, most of us did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of vegans and animal activists were once hippies in the 60s.
Now, right. Yeah, it shows. It shows. You don't have to scratch too far. Huh?
Yeah.
For me, political activism began when I was 15 years old in 1968, when Gene McCarthy was running for president and Robert Kennedy as well. And I worked for McCarthy. I spent my whole summer working for McCarthy. And that was when I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. It was the first time I ever saw or met lawyers. And these were lawyers who were change agents. They wanted to change the world for the better. And I thought, wow, that's what I want to do. So that took me down that road of wanting to be a lawyer. Not the kind who makes lots of money, which, and there's no problem with that, but that just wasn't of interest. And I've proven that. I haven't made a lot of money. So it was combining those two threads of my love of animals, my passion for animals, and the law that took another 11 years until 1979 when I was out of law school, and somehow I'd lost the social justice thread in law school. Imagine that, Tom. and I got out of law school not knowing what I wanted to do. I thought maybe I'd go into environmental law because at least then, you know, some of the land I would try to save would have animals on it. But it wasn't until I met another lawyer in San Francisco, where I was now living, who was also interested in animal rights. And to take a step back, when I was in law school in 74 to 77, that's when Peter Singer's book Animal Liberation first came out. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I'm sure you can all attest, for a lot of us, that put a philosophy onto what we were intuitively feeling.
You know, there's been so much progress in animal law in the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, what was the landscape like, Joyce, when you came out of law school for animal law? What were the opportunities like?
Funny question, Tom. There were none. There were none. There was no animal law. I didn't know any lawyers practicing. There simply were no lawyers practicing animal law. The closest, I think, would be, and I didn't find this until later, those lawyers who were working for groups like the Humane Society of the U.S. There were, I think, one or two of them. And there were just a few people who had somehow figured out how to talk some humane society that had the money into hiring them as corporate counsel. That was the animal law. Groups like the Fund for Animals, if they wanted to sue, which they rarely did, and the groups really didn't use litigation hardly at all at that time. The groups like Fund for Animals and HSUS and ASPCA. That's just not what they did. That's not how they handled things. But when they did have a lawsuit, they would simply hire some local attorney wherever they happened to be, whether it was Iowa or Kansas or California or wherever. So what we came into was a blank slate. And we didn't look at it that way. When I say we, Larry Kesnick, who formed ALDF with me, and me, once the two of us met, we thought, well, if there are two of us, maybe there are more. And we put an ad in our local legal newspaper, and six people showed up. So we started meeting once a month. So the thing is, I'd learned from 1968 on how to be an activist, so that was the easy part, putting together a small group, holding meetings, having discussions. So we did that for a couple of years and did a few amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs is what those are. So started to get involved a little in the litigation, but we were all, you know, we all had full-time jobs, so we didn't have the resources to just get out there and start a law firm doing animal law. So it grew very, very slowly and organically, and we started to learn about other lawyers in other parts of the country who were also interested in this. And that was tough. This was, you know, 1979 to 1981. There was no internet, no cell phones, no computers. We had the phone.
Yeah.
And manual typewriters.
Been invented.
Yeah.
Well, Joyce, did you guys get any like blowback from any of your colleagues when you started to form these small groups of lawyers? Like, you know, you said six people showed up, but there's like hundreds and thousands of lawyers. So what was the opinion of your legal colleagues when you guys went off on this other direction?
No, they thought we were crazy, but I've faced that all my life. So. Weird little Joyce and her animals. You know? It wasn't anything new. And I guess we all had strong egos because, yeah, we were laughed at. But, you know, we had finally found, even if it was a small group, other people who were like us. And that was a joy. You know, people who thought the way that I did it was pretty lonely for the first, you know, almost three decades. So that earliest group, what happened after that was in 1981, Larry and I were called by a group called Animal Protection Institute. But at that time, they were a healthy-sized organization in Sacramento, and they had heard from someone on the Naval Weapons Testing Base in Southern California in the Mojave Desert that that the base had hired some sharpshooters, and they were going to shoot burros on successive weekends until they killed 5,000 of them because they were having a problem with burros coming onto the runway where their planes landed. And so as soon as we heard that, we said, well, this is terrible. And the weekend before, they had shot, I think, 500 or 600. And so it was a Thursday. They were going to go back out on Saturday, shoot another several hundred. And so Larry said, okay, Joyce, you want to do something? And I said, sure. And I pulled an all-nighter. And once we got the call, I decided that I wanted to get in court to try to stop this. And it was a Thursday evening. The only way I was going to get into court on time was to pull an all-nighter and fly down to Fresno, which was the correct district. And I did. And I got a TRO. And I'd only been out of law school for 3 years. So I really, I'd not been in federal court before. And I had no idea how difficult it was to get a TRO. But I did. So it put the halt on the shooting, and we spent the next 8 months just negotiating with the Navy and taking out some burros as needed, humanely, taking out meaning removing them, and ultimately we settled the case, and no more burros were killed. So 1981 was a really big year for us. As a result of that, we got a small grant from the Animal Protection Institute, and I left the firm and started doing the work full time. And later that year, there was and still is, there's a law professor now retired named Henry Mark Holzer. He was teaching at Brooklyn Law School. And he was the nexus. He was publishing something called the Animal Rights Law Reporter, which he published for 3 years. And he was meeting all of these various attorneys around the country. And he brought us all together in New York and Thanksgiving of 1981. And that's where I met Steve Wise and David Favor and Eleanor Moldegott, who was then with the ASPCA, and a number of other people. And as a result of that, we were able to form a national board of directors. And it was small, and we were all, you know, pioneers. But having each other and being able to work together made all the difference.
And Joyce, one of the things that when I was in law school that ALDF opened my eyes to was the very limited legal protections that there are for animals, especially at the federal level. I think for most of us, we just have this vague idea of the Animal Welfare Act. We hear it and we think, oh, that probably does great things to protect animals. And I know you all went on to do some great work involving the AWA. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about really how the AWA operates and and actually doesn't help us very much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're absolutely right, Tommy. The more each of us gets into it, the more we realize what the laws don't do. then you dig in and say, okay, what can we do with this? Mm-hmm. But with the AWA, in 1985, the Animal Welfare Act was amended. It's a federal law that's intended to provide minimum protections for animals used in research and animals in transport and animals in captivity, wildlife in captivity in roadside zoos and zoos. When the act was passed, it was given to the or assigned to the U.S. Department of Agriculture to enforce. And they had asked Congress not to put them in charge of the act. They didn't want to enforce it. And they followed through on that quite well over the years. So when we were just getting our feet under us, in 85, Congress amended the Animal Welfare Act in some significant ways. They brought about what's called the IACUC, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, to provide some oversight within the universities where research is conducted, so that a committee would be taking a look at the protocols that researchers were planning to do and analyzing them with regard to were there other alternatives to the use of animals and what was the pain level that was going to be involved, could they do something less painful. In theory, it's a great committee. In practice, what has happened is because of the law being written in a way that was rather vague, only one person on this animal IACUC committee is mandated to be someone who represents the interests of the community. That doesn't mean the person's an animal rights or an animal protection activist. And in fact, oftentimes a priest or a researcher from another lab is brought in to fill the community role. These committees tend to be large. They might be 15 people. You've got one who's supposedly representing the interests of the community. So you can see that in terms of protecting animals, I think in some ways these committees have worked. Just asking the questions, if they're asked in good faith, is good. But in many cases, they are just rubber stamps. And today, there's legislation being introduced, National Association of Biomedical Research and others. Actually, it's not at the point of legislation yet, but they are recommending, these are advocates for research and the use of research in animals, are recommending that the IACOC meet far less frequently, and they are suggesting other recommendations that would severely weaken an already weak Animal Welfare Act. But, the act is very broad. It doesn't control in any way, shape, or form what research can be done or how painful it will be. It's really a before and after act for the most part. It sets standards for veterinary care, cage sizes, things of that ilk. In 85, the amendments that came in also mandated use of anesthesia and analgesia, painkillers, which obviously had to be mandated because they weren't being used, because that cost money. It brought us into the world of the use of animals in research, and it's been a very long, ugly trudge for us in that world. We brought a total of four cases over the next 15 years. And honestly, we lost every single one of them, mostly on the issue of standing. And have you talked about standing? I'll bet you have.
Not on this show. At least in years.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in its simplest terms, standing is your ability to get into court, to get in the front door in the first place. And the simplest way to explain it is if I'm driving and Tom is driving in front of me and I hit him in the back of his car, he stops and I ram right into the back of his car, he can sue me if I don't agree to pay up. He can sue me for the damage to his car. He can say that his neck was damaged. These are very direct injuries that he can prove. But if one of you is standing on the side of the road when this happens and says, wait a minute, let's say Tom decides he doesn't want to sue, and you say, well, I want to sue because you injured Tom, and I think you should pay up. You don't have standing. You don't have a direct enough interest in the injury.
So, yeah, I can see how it would be hard to demonstrate standing against pain and suffering to an animal used in research because, really, it's outside of what you're doing in your life, so.
Right.
But
exactly.
Let me toss out another example. What if I sued the federal government because the National Park Service was killing the bison of Yellowstone? I was a National Park Service ranger for 30 years, and it bothered me quite a lot that the Park Service was killing bison to protect the meat industry. Do I have any standing there?
Again, it's a very tough one. The way that environmental groups have gained standing is to claim that they have aesthetic standing. If you are a photographer who wants to photograph the bison in their natural habitat and you're not able to photograph bison because they've all been scared away or large numbers of them been killed and you're seeing them lying on the ground bleeding to death, you could potentially claim, yes, that you have standing to sue for the harm that's been caused to you and your ability to photograph beautiful bison in their natural habitat or enjoy them in their natural habitat. Beyond that, you'd have to get more creative.
Yeah.
You'd have to get more creative and somehow figure out some
health.
Very direct. Yeah, the mental health way is a tough way to go.
not with Greg.
Yeah. One way that we've been able to, and I'm moving away from the Animal Welfare Act now, but one way that we've been able to get standing, at least in some states, California, has laws that enable people to sue for the harm done to them if a business is using misleading or false advertising. Oh. Mm-hmm. So let's say that someone is purchasing eggs and they're willing to pay $5 for a dozen instead of $2.99 because the company that's charging $5 says that the chickens are all out in the field, they're scratching for bugs, they have the sunlight on their backs, they're having a wonderful life, and in fact the chickens are all in a massive facility where they never see the sun, they never see the light, and they're cramped together very closely. So then, if you were spending that extra $3 or $2, whatever, the extra money you were spending would enable you to say, I have been financially harmed because of the misleading statements. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? I mean, we're turning ourselves into pretzels.
Yeah, exactly.
trying to get standing in court. It's something we always have to think about.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like it. Well, another thing, just following back up on the Animal Welfare Act, you said it's a broad law, but in fact, it only protects vertebrate animals, and so a lot of invertebrate animals are not protected by the law. So I just wanted to point out, in some ways, it's not very broad at all.
Right.
Well, yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And with regard to the use of rats and mice and birds in research, all of them are specifically exempted.
Yeah.
From the law. And mice and rats are 95% of all animals used in research. So only 5% of the animals used in research are covered by this law. And it was pretty dispiriting over a 15-year period to keep getting kicked out of court on the issue of standing. It's a little bit more complex than that. We would go to the district court where we would win, and then it would go up to the Court of Appeals on the D.C. Circuit, and they would kick us out on standing, and they did that pretty consistently. We finally got standing, but not for someone in a research lab. It was someone going into a roadside zoo who wanted to see humane conditions and use that aesthetic standing argument, and we were able to convince the court that, yes, someone going to a roadside zoo who's paid for the ticket wants to see humanely handled animals and sees animals who are being poorly handled, which is the case with many, if not most, roadside zoos, has standing to bring an action under the Animal Welfare Act.
Yeah, that's great, Joyce. And, you know, we've barely scratched the surface with you and animal law and all the great work that the Animal Legal Defense Fund does. Would you be up for joining us for another interview?
I'd be happy to, sure.
Okay, great. And can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about the Animal Legal Defense Fund?
The Animal Legal Defense Fund has a website at ALDF.org.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Joyce.
Yeah, thanks, Joyce.
All right, thank you.
Happy holidays.
If you'd like to learn more about a vegan diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org. There you will also find a calendar of events that tells about the upcoming events we plan to hold.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. From all of us at ACK Radio, we wish you a very happy holidays. I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Greg Lawson.
For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.